another opinion says it was divided based on Ba'ei Ha'aretz, those who came to the Eretz Yisrael. And there's a third opinion that we paskin like, which is most complicated of all. And the third opinion says this. The third opinion says the number of portions was determined by Ba'ei Ha'aretz, but then it was subdivided based on Yotzei Mitzrayim. Let me explain how this works. Let us assume that Reuven and Shimon are brothers. Reuven and Shimon are brothers, and they leave Egypt. They're both 25 years old. In the desert, Reuven has 5 children, and Shimon has 2 children. Reuven and Shimon both die. We now have these 7 kids, right? 5 brothers and 2 cousins, 5 and 2. They come to Eretz Yisrael. How many portions of land? Again, we divide Eretz Yisrael into 603,000 equal portions. How many portions will they get? So this third of now, again, let's take all the opinions that we know. If I say Ba'ei Ha'aretz together, you know, Reuven's children will get one portion, which would be divided 5 ways. I'm sorry. If I say Yotzei Mitzrayim, Reuven's kids will get one portion that is divided 5 ways. Shimon's kids will get one portion that is divided 2 ways, which means each child of Shimon will get more land than the child of Reuven, because if you go back to Yotzei Mitzrayim, there were just 2 people who left. That's if I say Yotzei Mitzrayim. If I say Ba'ei Ha'aretz, you look at the people who came, it turns out every person who comes gets the same thing. Reuven's 5 children gets 5 portions of land. And Shimon's 2 children get 2 portions. In other words, each person gets the same portion. That's if it's a pure Ba'ei Ha'aretz. But the compromise position is this. I have 7 people, therefore I give 7 portions of land. But I don't give one person a portion. After I determine the portions of lands, I then take all of that land and I move backward and say, this land now belongs to Reuven and Shimon, who left Egypt, which will then be inherited equally by their various descendants. In other words, the Gemara calls this reverse inheritance. Normally, inheritance goes from the dead to the living. People die, and it goes from here. The way it works, this is based on drushes of Pesukim, the way it works is the people who are alive, the 7 children of Reuven and Shimon, bequeath their property to their ancestors who left Egypt. This is an example of the alive bequeathing to the living. The alive bequeathing to the dead. And then it is as if Reuven and Shimon, the 2 brothers, are in possession of this total area of land. And then when they die, it goes to their various descendants in equal portions. So what you're going to have is that, it's divided half, that's right. So half of the land belongs to Reuven, half of the land belongs to Shimon. Again, we start off with 7 parcels of land. Right? 7 parcels of land based on Ba'ei Ha'aretz.
But they're not the same size.
Yeah, they are the same size. You started off with 7 equal parcels of land. The 7 equal parcels of land are then bequeathed to their ancestors who left Egypt. And at that point, it is as if, this is all theoretical, it is as if Reuven has 3.5 parcels of land and Shimon has 3.5 parcels of land. The 3.5 parcels are then divided among Reuven's 5 sons. And the 3.5 parcels of Shimon are divided among Shimon's 2 sons. So it turns out that, once again, Reuven's children will get more. I'm sorry, not Reuven. Shimon's 2 children will get more than Reuven's 5 children.
If you're giving each one of 5 portions to one,
no, okay, I left out one step. You have to bequeath it to a common ancestor of Reuven and Shimon. So it goes back to the theoretical Yaakov. Again, let's do it this way. Reuven, yeah, let me give you the example, take all 3 opinions. Reuven and Shimon leave Egypt. They're at the age of 25. Reuven has 2 children in the desert. And Shimon has 5 children in the desert. Or maybe I reversed it before. Okay. Reuven has 2, Shimon has 5. Now Reuven and Shimon, because they were 20 years old when they left the Mitzrayim, they are going to die in the desert. They're not going to survive. But their seven combined children will enter Eretz Yisrael. Now the question is, how much land will these seven kids get? So, the first two opinions are fairly simple. According to opinion number one, the census is based on land that would have been given to the people who left Egypt. So, had Reuven and Shimon not sinned, they would have come to Eretz Yisrael. Reuven would have gotten one share. Shimon would have gotten one share. Now, Reuven and Shimon died, but therefore, since Reuven would have gotten one share, so in effect, Reuven's two kids take one share of land and divide it in two. Since Shimon would have gotten one share, so we give the five children of Shimon one share of land, which they divide in five. That's Yotzei Mitzrayim. Is that clear? Yotzei Mitzrayim means you don't look at who's coming in. That the division is based on those who left Egypt. That's correct. In other words, we regard Eretz Yisrael as belonging by right to the generation who left Egypt. And those who come in are simply inheriting their parents' or their grandparents' land. Therefore, what you get when you come in is not on your own right. What you get when you come in is inheriting your father's or your grandfather's rights. That's simple. Okay. Now, the second way... No, that's the third. I'm coming back to it. I'm going over this. Now, the second way says that because the generation who left Egypt sinned and they forfeited their right to Eretz Yisrael, so the generation that's coming in are claiming their own claim to the land. They're not saying, I'm inheriting my grandfather's property. I am coming in my own right. Therefore, if two people come in, they get two portions. If five people come in, they get five portions. Which means the five children of Reuven will each get just as much as the two children of Shimon. Each person has the same right to a parcel of land. So if the two children of Reuven come, they get two portions. If the five children of Shimon come, they get five portions. This is not the third
round. This is all within the tribal division.
Yes, I'll discuss how you interact that. We're assuming within a tribe. We'll discuss how tribal division. That's a second argument that is superimposed on top of
that. The rest of the tribe gets.
Well, no. In other words, according to
you,
I'm sorry. I don't mean to try. I'm talking about once. Okay, once land. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to try. I'm assuming. I'm going in a more micro. I am assuming a tribe has already been allocated land. Let's say Yehuda. The boundaries of Yehuda, as recorded in the Book of Shemot, are the entire southern quarter of Eretz Yisrael. Yehuda has the south of Eretz Yisrael, from Yerushalayim southward. Okay, that is Yehuda. Let's assume that Yehuda contains, this is just an arbitrary number, Yehuda contains 52,000 acres. Let us assume that there are 52,000 members of the tribe of Yehuda who are coming to Eretz Yisrael. If I say, Bo'ei Ha'aretz, that I simply look at the people who are coming in, if 52,000 people who are the age of 20 are coming in, I will give each one 1 acre of land. That's Bo'ei Ha'aretz, that's the second, each one. If I go with the first approach of Yotzei Mitzrayim, it's a bit more complicated because I don't look at the 52,000 people who enter Eretz Yisrael. I look at the 52,000 people, which is really almost the same number as recorded in Bamidbar, right, who left Mitzrayim. I allocate the acres to those 52,000 people, and how that's going to be subdivided will depend on the inheritance situation. In other words, again, if you go back with my Reuven and Shimon, who are people, not tribes, right? Chaim and Shmuel. Chaim and Shmuel, only two people. But their grandchildren may turn out to be, you know, five here and two here. So does each one get an acre, or do I assign the acre to a Reuben and to a Shimon, and then that's going to be subdivided? If I say Yotzei Mitzrayim, it's going to turn out that if somebody who left Egypt had a lot of children, or a lot of grandchildren, each of those kids is going to get much less than somebody who didn't have a lot of children. Okay, those are the two opinions. Okay?
That's easy.
Those are easy. Huh? Okay, third way.
Seven brothers,
right.
And the father dies, it's equally...
That's right, that's right, that's right, that's right.
How many children they have?
That's correct, that's correct. Okay, now, third way. Now again, we're all assuming that the land has already been assigned to a tribe, but we're talking about within a tribe, how do you divvy up land? That's what we're talking about. Okay, the third way is this. The third way is...
Practically speaking.
Okay.
You use technical terms and it goes back,
Okay, we'll use the acreage as an example. Let's assume, again, we're going to the example, there was a Chaim and a Shmuel who left Egypt. Chaim had, and they're all of the Shevet Yehuda. Chaim has two sons who enter Eretz Yisrael. Shmuel has seven sons. Okay. We say the following. In terms of acreage, the acreage that will be distributed, we look at the number of people entering Eretz Yisrael. Since there are seven people entering Eretz Yisrael, these two families will get 7 acres. So that's the same as the Yotzei Mitzrayim, as by Ha'aretz. Okay. But now, how do we divide up those 7 acres? So we say the following. Instead of saying each person gets 1 acre, we say that we take these 7 acres, and in a reversal of the normal rules of inheritance, which normally say the dead give to the living, we say in this case, the living bequeath it back to the dead, which means the children of Chaim and Shmuel bequeath it backwards till they hit a common ancestor who's long dead. Now the common ancestor of Chaim and Shmuel will be Chaim and Shmuel's father. So we treat these 7 acres as if they belonged to Yaakov. Now, 1 second. If you do that, you then have to reconstruct the inheritance. Because after you've gone from the living to the dead, you reconstruct the inheritance going from the dead to the living. Now, if Yaakov had owned 7 acres in Israel, when he died, 3.5 would go to Chaim, and 3.5 would go to Shmuel. When Chaim dies, his 3.5 would be divided two ways, and Shmuel's 3.5 would be divided five ways. Huh?
It's a compromise.
So it's still, so in other words, you use the Bai Haaretz to determine the total acreage, but then you subdivide it based on the Yotzei Mitzrayim.
How do you decide how far back to go? Then the only thing you can do is go back to the tribe.
Yeah, it
if you're going back past
how far
Chaim
you go back?
And
yeah.
Shmuel, then the only place you're going to get so you go
back to Chaim and Shmuel's father. You know, you go back to the first common ancestor. And the question is,
brothers,
how do you... Chaim and Shmuel are brothers. So if Chaim and Shmuel are brothers, their common ancestor would be their father. Their father.
The question is, what's the advantage of
doing
this?
Yeah,
the advantage
over what? Depends over which way.
The third way.
Yeah, but the advantage of the third way over which way? The advantage...
No, because it's more equitable for everybody. It's more complicated, even though...
Yeah, of course it's more complicated. Yeah,
know, but,
yeah.
So the idea is why, you know, it's simple if you do it by your semi-tribe, or if you do it by...
No, it's predicated on two notions. There are two contradictory notions here. On one hand... it wouldn't be fair to allocate the land based on the Egyptian census because those people are dead. Those aren't the people coming. So we want to have acreage based on numbers of people who come in, but since the people who left Mitzrayim did have a share of the land, they should have gotten the land, so we have to use them as the basis.
So it's more than a couple of things?
Well, the Torah doesn't give a reason exactly. I'm not sure
it's
I understand.
Equitable.
No, but the two of a father whose brother had five children benefit, but
that's
he
correct.
Had more children.
They benefit, but not to the same extent as they would benefit.
They benefit
that's
more.
True.
No.
If it was divided in just the way they came in, everybody would be equitable. If it was divided from the original,
Israel.
they would have gotten just the half of five.
Oh, one second. If you follow Yotzei Mitzrayim, that's right. If,
no, if
you follow Yotzei Mitzrayim, the people with small families benefit more than the people with big families. If you follow this compromise, the people with big
families benefit even more from their uncles
right.
having had a
right.
lot of children.
Right.
What
right.
is the
that's
sense
right.
of that?
Right. Okay, I don't know. It's hard enough to explain this. I can't give the reason.
But your question is, you can always go back to a common ancestor. Everyone has a common ancestor.
It's better to have less.
So presumably, I think you go back to a common ancestor if the common ancestor also left Mitzrayim. In other words, Chaim and Shmuel's father left Mitzrayim. If there is no common ancestor left Mitzrayim, then you wouldn't apply this one, and you would just look at the Goy Haaretz. You see what I'm saying? In other words, if Chaim and Shmuel left with their father, and they all died in the desert, and you have five kids and two kids, then you would make this hybrid division.
I'm confused. I thought
the
land was to be
divided. Why do you have to go back
among the tribes?
Because Chaim and Shmuel are brothers.
Right.
Now, the children of Chaim, see, otherwise you won't do anything, because the children of Chaim can give it back to Chaim. But if they give it back to Chaim, they'll just get the same five portions. In other words, unless you go to the common ancestor, the inheritance backwards doesn't accomplish anything. Because they got five portions. They give it back to their father. They'll get five portions. The way you reallocate is by going one step above that. And then it gets redivided in a different way.
So if there were, the issue is really then if there were, Chaim and Shmuel had more brothers, then that has to be taken
into account. Right, yes, all the brothers, right. Now, let me just end with one point. Now, this was assuming you had a tribal division. I've been talking about right now how you divide the lands within a tribe, which is important. That's not really discussed in the book of Yoshua that much. But how do you divide tribal lands? In other words, how do you determine what tribe gets what land? So here we have an argument. The Torah itself describes a goral, a lottery, which means Eretz Yisrael was divided up into 12 segments. Actually, not 12, because Reuven and Gad got their land separately in the east bank of the Jordan. So really you have 10 portions of the land. So you have 10 slips of paper that says Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Not Levi. Reuven, Levi also didn't. Actually, Levi also didn't have land. So you have to exclude Levi. So you have nine. So you have nine slips of paper. Menashe and Ephraim count for two. So you have 10 tribes. Right? You know, half of Menashe took Aver Hayarden, but half of Menashe took Eretz Israel. And you have 10 boundaries. And Elazar, the Kohen Gadol, who succeeded Aaron, would pick up Reuven's slip of paper and would pick up a boundary and would match Reuven to the boundary, and this was through Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, so each tribe got its correct boundary. First of all, one thing that we're not given a good detail about is who drew the boundaries. I mean, granted, the Goral tells us how you matched the tribe and the boundary, but who drew the boundaries? Notice the Chumash does not describe, in the Chumash at least, it certainly does not describe the boundaries of a tribe. It describes the boundaries of Israel. So we'll see in the book of Yoshua that apparently Yoshua did this through his own surveyors. He appointed surveyors to kind of divide the land into various districts. And then the Goral took over which tribe got which. And again, Rashi brings the point, all of this was Ruach HaKodesh, so there would be a voice, literally a voice from heaven would announce ahead of time, this is what the Goral will produce, etc. So, now, the Ramban says the following. The Ramban says, well, gee, Goral doesn't make sense unless the land was divided into equal portions. Because when Yoshua is surveying the land, he doesn't know that the south will go to Yehuda yet. That's not going to be determined until the Goral. So how can you say, well, the south goes to Yehuda, so it has to be bigger, and this goes to Ephraim, this is be smaller, but you don't know that yet. So how can you survey and divide up the land and then determine which tribe will get it by lottery unless somehow it was all equal? Otherwise, you could have the situation where the small tribe gets the big land and the big tribe gets the small land. So the Ramban assumes that the Goral meant Eretz Yisrael was divided. And again, I mean, no map agrees with this. You will not see any map that says that. So I understand that it's not indicated by the geography in Yoshua, but the Ramban's opinion in Halacha was, tribally, Eretz Yisrael was divided into 12 equal sections, and then they were assigned via the Goral. Now, according to this, everything that I discussed, whether Eretz Yisrael was divided to the Ba'i Ha'aretz, or it was divided to the Yotzei Mitzrayim, or it was divided in a hybrid, that only applied within that 1/12 of the land that a tribe got. Of course, the inequity with the Ramban's position can be very readily understood. That means, in effect, if you were a member of a big tribe, you received much less land than if you were a member of a tribe. Because Yehuda had to be divided into, the same amount of land, same amount of acreage, had to be divided among a much larger number of people. Whichever formula you apply, whether you apply the Mitzrayim formula, whether you apply the Ba'i Ha'aretz formula, or whatever you apply, you're certainly dividing the same area by a much larger number of people.
Is there any sense of taking into account the wealth of the land? In other words, X number of acres in Jezreel is very different from X number of acres.
Right. There is, but the Ramban seems to say that all of that was taken into account in the equality of it. In other words, the shares were supposed to be, some of them may have been larger in area, but not as wealthy. Others were wealthier. But the point still would be that a person from a smaller tribe would either get more lands or better land. In other words, there still was not equality among tribes.
When the Ramban said he divided up equally, right, does he mean that he divided up equally that everyone gets the same? Well, if he means equally, then does he mean equally population-wise? In other words,
no, he means equally by tribe, which means by tribe. That's his point. Each tribe got the same.
Exact same amount.
That seems to be, which again is not
an indication, because equal can mean that equal. Each
one. That's his whole point. I mean, the Ramban's point is that it's impossible to set up a lottery unless the shares are equal. You can't divide Eretz Yisrael into unequal shares and then have a lottery, because the lottery... there's Ruach HaKodesh, of course, but you don't set it up that way.
When were these maps up? Were these maps all subsequent? Because all maps show different amounts, and it shows also different wealth.
All the geography is largely speculative, and again, his position doesn't seem to be accepted by any map at all to say that the shares were equal.
Well, they're also when you go through different names of different cities, there are. I mean, I know when you see the administrative sections mentioned by Shlomo, there are cities mentioned.
Right,
there are cities
right.
mentioned within each which constitute borders, so you can somehow, I assume, that the cartographers used the information that was given of the cities that are mentioned in each, so it wasn't so far-fetched.
But the answer to that, the Ramban might say, as we suggested, that the equality was not necessarily in acreage, but it was in economic, in other words, 1 acre here might be worth 3 acres there, so even if the areas are different, but there was fundamental equality per tribe. But you still have a problem. If there's equality per tribe, that means the person in a larger tribe is either getting less acreage or less valuable when you spread it out.
That's actually true. I mean, that's the way it works today also. You have 12 children, but 12 children in most cases, an equal income.
Right.
You have two GS-15s making one with 12 children, one with two. The two children are going to have more clothes than the 12 children.
Now the Abar Badal.
Was Yehoshua directed to survey? Is he doing it on his own?
It doesn't say he was directed to survey, but it must. Yeah, it's not clear. We'll have to see. Now let me just say on most people, and most people learn that you work backwards. In other words, according to the Ramban, first there is the tribal division. And then there's the per capita division within the constraints of the tribal division. Most Mefarshim learn exactly the opposite. You first determine how much acreage you have to give to a tribe based on the various formulas that we looked at. Yotzei Mitzrayim. Once you've determined your acreage, you then determine how much that tribe is going to get. In other words, what a tribe gets is a function of number of people times acres. And instead of saying you divide it for the tribe, and then within that tribe you subdivide it, most Mefarshim learn that the larger tribes had larger land allotments. The smaller tribes had smaller land allotments. And the theory would be that an individual in the tribe of Yehuda should get as much land, an individual, as an individual in the tribe of Yisachar. Now granted, within Yehuda you may have those disparities based on the formulas that we looked at in giving land to individuals, but you worked backwards by first determining allotments and then determining how much land a tribe will get. Now the question becomes, so where does the Goral fit in? Where does the lot fit in? So the so actually Rashi says the whole thing was kind of a setup in advance where Yehoshua knew that Yehuda would get that big piece of land. So therefore, in effect, he could designate the southern boundary as big enough for Yehuda, because he knew that the Goral would come up that way. In other words, essentially, the surveying itself knew the result of the Goral. But the Bar Benel, I think, says something that's convincing. The Bar Benel says that the Goral was never a precise boundary. The Goral just indicated what part of the country the boundary would be. In other words, there's the northern section, there's the southern section, there's the eastern section, there's the center section. And the exact acreage, however, would not be determined till you knew the result of the Goral. So you had a very simple thing. In other words, Yeshua divided the land into various districts, but without delineating the acreage in each district. In other words, this is a general district, that's a district, general district. Goral determines which tribe would get which district. However, only after the Goral will we then determine the precise acreage by looking at the size of the tribe. So the Goral says Yehuda gets the south. Once Yehuda gets the south, we then have 54,000 people to deal with, so we have to give boundaries that are big enough to give everybody 1 acre, 54,000 acres. If the Yamin would have gotten the south, then that would have been much much smaller. So the Rav Benel says that the Goral dealt with general districts, and there was no precise acreage until later.
Yeshua came in before.
Say again?
Yeshua came in before
when? No, according to the Rav Benel says that Yehoshua surveyed the lands. Yehoshua determined various districts and natural characteristics, right? There are mountains, there are streams, there are valleys, there are agriculture, there's mining, there's fishing. There are various ways you can divide lands. And he did not determine the precise acreage of these districts. And then there was a Goral. So there are 10 slips of paper with the tribes. And then there are 10 geographical regions in Eretz Israel. The Goral matches the Shevets with the geographical region. Once the match was made, the precise acreage would then be determined by the formulas that we had looked at, either looking at the people who left Egypt, or the people coming in, or the hybrid. See? Again, according to Rashi, what you did was, Yehoshua had already predetermined the exact boundaries. So that didn't make sense, really, because how does he know which tribe is going to get it if that's a function of the tribes? So Rashi says, well, Yehoshua knew Baruch HaKodesh, what the Goral would in fact do. According to Ramban, the Goral worked. Eretz Yisrael was divided into 10 equal portions. And all of the subdivisions occurred within those equal portions. The Bar Benel says Yehoshua left the acreage indeterminate until the Goral determined which tribe would get which lands. Okay, so those are the mechanisms. So that makes sense. The only problem is that you really cannot leave districts too indeterminate, because eventually, you know, if you divide the land into 10 districts, by definition, you may find that the need for one district may infringe on the boundary of another district, so it's not really clear. But apparently he left enough breathing room among the joints, as it were, for there to be expansion as necessary to accommodate a population.
There were problems among the borders, that's precisely.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we will see that the Bnei Menashe complained they didn't have enough land in Eretz Yisrael. They were cheating.
By this time, there's no indication at all that there's any earthquake. in this division of land, are we dividing everybody equally, or are we...
Yeah, that's a good point. In this division of land, there is no priority to a kor, unless you consider Yosef as a firstborn child of Rachel and double portion of Ephraim and Manasseh. But
that's more establishes the precedent that you can divide by the second generation of the
right,
first.
Right. But as far as we know, this initial division of land, this initial division of land, did not give a double portion to a firstborn son.
I think Yosef thought he was entitled
to Joseph. Yosef and Manasseh,
yeah. Yeah, the descendants of...
Right, Manasseh is going to...
They were entitled to more because they were...
Yeah.
In other words, their ancestors.
Right. Yeah, we'll see that.
It's not true that the third method is worse for the larger families. Not in absolute terms, anyway. Maybe if I'm figuring correctly. If you assume that each person, no matter which method you use, if you have, let's say, 10 acres,
right.
So if you use the first method, so then Chaim and Shmuel is entitled to 10 acres each.
Let me get the case again. You're talking about Chaim and Shmuel died in the desert.
Right. So there
and they have how many
if
sons?
If we're doing it by...
How many sons did each have?
One had five and one had
five
two. So they're each entitled to 10. So the one with two kids gets 5 acres each. The one with five kids gets 2 acres each.
Right.
Right?
Right.
If you're doing it by who entered Eretz Israel, so then you've got
each one gets
10 acres each, period,
right?
Each person.
Right.
If you do it the third way, you're dealing with 70 acres.
70 acres, it goes back
which are going to go back to be divided.
Father of Chaim and Shmuel.
Right, but then it's Chaim, so Chaim and Shmuel each get 35 acres.
And 35 divided by 5 is 7.
7.
And 35
divided by 2 is 17 and a half. So they do come out ahead of the first method in absolute
time. That's right. Yeah. That's correct.
So it's not so terrible for them.
That's correct. They come out ahead. Yeah. Again, it all depends on which method you're comparing it to. Certainly, they come out better. They come out optimal if you just look at them. You know what I'm saying? And Boy Haaretz.
Compared to... For those who count by who's entering Eretz Israel, then certainly that's better.
They would do better
for
the large family.
The big family, and the small
family. But the large family does fare better in the third way than they would on the first one.
Right.
That's correct. That's right. Okay, so keep in mind that what's complicated here is we have two different layers of problems, and the problem is how do you combine them. One is the tribal division of Eretz Israel, and the other is the sub-tribal division, and whether the tribal division was a functional division. Barbanel basically says you could not decide how much land the tribe gets unless you work backwards from how much the individuals in the tribe get. And therefore, Barbanel was forced to conclude that the Goral was only a general geographical thing. It did not give precise boundaries, and the survey Yoshua ordered was only was not a boundary survey, it was a geographical survey. Ramban says, on the other hand, that there was a precise demarcation of Eretz Yisrael into 10 equal parts.
What about Yaakov's bracha? Certain tribes require it to be in certain places, right?
The Barbanel says that, we'll look at that. Basically, that was the guideline, that was one of the primary guidelines Yoshua was looking at. In other words, in determining, but once again though, see the Torah does say the land has to be determined by Goral. Now Yaakov's blessing is Yaakov's blessing, but you have to obey the mitzvah of the Torah. But it did come out that the Goral did represent a fulfillment of Yaakov's blessing. We'll see that. Zevulun was also, although it says, well, it's interesting. If you look at the map, although it says Zevulun l'chof yamim, Zevulun is on the shores of the sea. If you look at most maps, I don't believe they show Zevulun on the Mediterranean coast. But the chof yamim seems to be the Yam Kineret.
Oh.
And I think so. If you look at the
trade there.
I don't know. And I'll show you another very big problem is that tribes sometimes had their lands not in one place. It was like East Pakistan and West, the old West Pakistan. So somebody might have been inland, and they may have had a stretch. They may have had a port on the coast. Dan, for example. Shimon did not even have separate territory. Shimon had a number of cities that were in the middle of Yehuda. So it's very complicated because the boundaries were not all separate, clearly demarcated areas. But you're correct that we will see that although it was assigned by Gorel, because the Torah says in Pinchas, but by and large you can trace a fulfillment of Yaakov's blessing. But Yaakov's blessing does not become a commandment. It's Yaakov's blessing.
I know, but it's the Ruach HaKadosh. Yeah, so it works
out
that way. It
works out that way.
Maybe the problem's with the word Gorel.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're having all these things. You say, "Oh, but it has to be by Gorel." What is Gorel?
Well, the Gemara says Gorel literally meant lottery. Gorel meant like we have by Haman. He feel poor who are Gorel, and Haman.
But it's always
that
there's always even there. There's an element of Ruach.
Obviously.
So the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants it to work out that way.
That's why I haven't won the lottery yet.
It worked out. It worked out.
The concept of the Baruch Hu is that the blessing is that he's foreshadowing. So he wasn't dictating what he knew what the lottery was.
That's a question. No, that's an excellent question, but that is a question. In other words, it's not really clear if Yaakov was functioning as a prophet, or this was Yaakov's blessing. Was he foreshadowing, or was he dictating? Of course, he can't dictate in a sense.
Can you talk about just at that particular period of history?
Yaakov's blessing?
Yeah.
What period? I mean, they weren't in Israel then.
Are we talking about immediately, as soon as they end in? Is this a general nature of people, l'chof yamim? Does that mean natural yamim, or does it mean just commerce or trade?
There are different meanings, but generally we'll see that, we'll try to compare it as we go through, that the geographical references in Yaakov's blessing and in Moshe Rabbeinu's blessing. Moshe Rabbeinu also has a number of references in Los Abrecha. Were fulfilled in the Gorel, but it was the Gorel's fulfillment. They couldn't just do it on their own.
They're also dividing the land they hope to have at this point. They don't control totally all these pieces.
We'll
of
see.
Land.
It depends. The initial divisions, they did conquer big stretches of land in the south and a lot of land in the north. And the initial division that we see, we have the two tribes, Reuben, Gad, and Kartis, which they already have, and Yehuda in the south. And the rest of Menashe also has a northern stretch, which is really congruous with the Menashe on the other side of the Yarden, up there, which is south of Kinneret. The rest of the land, we'll see that basically, it's an interesting point. A lot of the tribes did not want to get their land allocated if it hadn't been conquered yet, for a very good reason. Once land is allocated, it then becomes that tribe's responsibility to conquer it. Until it's been distributed to the tribe, it's national land. So actually, they were hoping that Yeshua would not give them the land until it was already conquered. That's right. They wanted it to be a national endeavor. And it wouldn't have become, once it's Menashe's land, it's Menashe's business to go get it. Which was the situation later. There was a lot of land that was not conquered. The land was distributed. We'll find that Menashe complains, we don't have enough land. And Yeshua's response is, you know, go and get those Canaanites out of the forest that are in heaven. You know, you have the land, you just have to have the responsibility for repelling your enemies.
What point was the division done?
The division was done 7 years of conquest, which was limited, and 7 years of division. 7 years of division. But some of the land that was divided was not conquered till David's time or even later. Okay. Yair was the son of
Yair.
the last word on the line in the left, it's Shin.
It's a Shin Bab. Yeah, Shomaat. Shomea, Shomaat.
Could you tell a little bit the definitions of those words one
time? Okay. Okay. Efshar, it's possible, or possible. Efshar, impossible. It's more the negative, okay? Lirkov, to dance. Okay? And okay, the present tense of dance. Me'anyen, interesting. Panui, pnuya, not busy. Don't you know the word for the English? Available. Free. Mm-hmm. Free. Yeah. Okay. Asuka, busy. Not a busy place. Not a busy day. I am busy. That's the only meaning of it. I don't know. Kol Noah, movie theater. Seret, movie. And driven, too. תקליטים, records. לשמוע, to hear, or to listen. It's more to hear than this. שומע, ושומע, present tense.
Moving with the hands.
No. Yes. Right, like film and...
And Theatron would be more like a concert hall?
Theatron would be theater.
Right, for plays.
And the place too, like
concert hall.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this would be concert. Concert. The symphony in Hebrew is concert. Concert. Okay. Amud 89, בבקשה. אורי ורות מדברים. שיחה, טלפון. טלפון, discussion or talk or
conversation.
אוקיי. הלו, אפשר לדבר עם רות? מדברת. מי מדבר? מדבר אורי. את לא זוכרת אותי? מה זה אותי? מי? Don't remember me, את פלס אני, אוקיי? רקדנו יחד במסיבה של דוד. מה זה יחד?
We danced together in the
party of דוד, כן. אה, כן. אתה בלונדיני, ואתה לומד פילוסופיה. לא. לא, אני לא בלונדיני ואני לא סטודנט. אתה לא סטודנט? אתה לא לומד באוניברסיטה? לא, אני עובד בתיאטרון.
It's an usher.
Yeah.
זה מעניין. מה אתה עושה שם? זה סיפור ארוך. מה זה ארוך? It's a long story. את רוצה לבוא הערב לדיסקוטק? תודה, לא. הערב אני עסוקה. אני הולכת לתיאטרון. מתי את פנויה? אני פנויה ביום חמישי בערב, אבל אני לא אוהבת דיסקוטקים. את אוהבת מוסיקה? כן, מאוד. יש לי תקליטים טובים. אפשר לשמוע מוסיקה בחדר שלי. ואפשר גם ללכת לקולנוע? טוב, אולי. אולי, מה זה אולי? מה מספר הטלפון שלך בבית? מספר הטלפון.
Torah records a complete census of the Jewish people in two different parshiyos. Census number one, a complete census, a tribe-by-tribe census, occurs in the beginning of the book of Bamidbor. At the beginning of the book of Bamidbor is given a date. It says, B'yachad l'chodesh hasheni l'shana hasheni. The first day of the second month, beginning the second year of the Exodus, right? We count the years in the Chumash always from Nisan. Every Rosh Chodesh Nisan is a new year. So Rosh Chodesh Iyar, which was what, 13 months after they left Egypt, or 12 and a half months after they left Egypt, there was a census that counted the people who left Mitzrayim. Right, that is a census, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and that is a tribal census. Now you know that this is the generation of people who left Egypt. These were the Jews who left Egypt. Now we, and of course the census counts people from 20, men from the age of 20 to 60. These are described as Yotzei Tzava. Now what does Yotzei Tzava mean? Most people translate those who go to the army. The concept is that military service was between the ages of 20 and 60. But that's Lav Dafka, that's not necessarily the correct translation. Yotzei Tzava might also mean those who assemble for community affairs. It's not necessarily a military connotation, although we use the word Tzava to mean army. Now we know that generation totally died out in the desert, because this was the generation who participated in the sin of the spies, which was just a few months later. And over a course of 40 years, all of those people died. Just as a digression, you may recall how the Gemara in Tainus describes how the generation of the Midbar died. They didn't die all at once. In fact, the way it worked was, every Tisha B'Av, because that's the anniversary of the Meraglim coming back with their reports, the night of Tisha B'Av, everybody would dig a grave, and they would sleep in the grave that night. They would all experience death. And those who had achieved their 60th birthday that year would not wake up the next morning. In other words, the way it worked was, the Gezeira was between 20 and 60. It occurred over a course of 40 years. So nobody died before their 60th birthday. But the whole generation would sleep in their graves, and in the morning, if you had reached 60, you wouldn't get up. Apparently you knew that. And if you were younger than 60, you would keep on, you'd live.
You want to have to sleep in the grave. I mean, if you knew that would be
No, because there was a concept of a symbolic death, that the whole generation had to experience that death.
They didn't die. They didn't.
Well, one group of people did die, but the rest of the people just experienced the death experience. By the way, it is brought down. You know, there is a concept in Judaism of remembering the day of death as a way of awakening yourself to tshuva. And it is brought down. There were gedolim, not too many. There were gedolim used to sleep in coffins to be able to have that type of very vivid memory of it. Okay. She did what?
Sarah Bernhardt slept in her coffin.
What was that?
Just wanted to get used to it.
All right. Now, the thing is, by the way, again, as a digression, this actually didn't work out very well, because the truth is, the 40 years of wandering in the desert was not from the Meraglim onward. It was really from the Exodus of Egypt. The Meraglim story occurred around a year and a half afterwards. There was only 38 and a half years of wandering after that point. So you really didn't catch everybody. Now, this is an interesting point. We know that the 15th of Av is considered to be kind of a semi-holiday. The 15th of Av, and it's not really a Yom Tov, but it's described, for example, that this was like the ancient Sadie Hawkins day, where if women didn't have a shidduch, they would get dressed up, and the men would kind of choose the women they'd want to marry, and you know, the rich women would say, you know, look at the wealth, and the poor women would say, look at the yichas, and, you know, everybody pointed out, and it is brought down that everybody had to dress the same, in a way that there shouldn't be jealousy in terms of dress and wardrobe, which is the argument in favor of school uniforms and the like. And the question is, why is the 15th of Av a happy day? You don't say Tachanun. So it actually says like this: the very last Tisha B'Av that they wandered in the deserts. Now this is approximately, let's say, Moshe died 7th of Adar, the next year. So this is around Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevet, Shabbat, Adar. So that's like five. It's around 7 months before Moshe Rabbeinu's death. People lay down in their kfarim, and nobody died. So they figured they had a wrong calendar. Maybe it wasn't the 9th of Av, maybe it was the 10th of Av. And they didn't know. But the one time they knew that Tisha B'Av had passed was when the 15th of the month came, and they saw a full moon. So they knew that the day had passed. So in effect, the 15th of Av became a holiday, because that was the day. God gave the last year, the last group of Jews, a freebie. He let them off the hook. And therefore, that the people who had reached 60 in the 40th year of wandering in the desert were able to enter Eretz Yisrael. And because of that, that's one reason why the 15th of Av is a Yom Tov. Another reason, which is not relevant to this, is that if you remember the book of Shoftim, a civil war was waged against the tribe of Binyamin because of a horrendous incident that happened to a woman who was raped and killed. So they waged war against Binyamin because of Pelegesh Begiva. And Binyamin was almost decimated, and indeed a ban was proclaimed that no one shall give his daughter to a member of Binyamin to marry. And the tribe almost was totally destroyed. And when they annulled the ban, that became a Yom Tov, because that prevented a segment of the Jewish people from being destroyed. So that's the 15th of Av. But in any event, generally speaking, the census in Parshas Bamidbar was the census of what we call Yotzei Mitzrayim, the people who had left Egypt. And most of them, except perhaps for the last generation, and except, of course, for Yehoshua and Kalev, and actually the women who were not counted in the census, but the women also did not participate in the sin of the spies, so many older women did, in fact, enter Eretz Israel. But generally speaking, the census of Bamidbar represents people who had died. The second census in the Torah is the census that appears in Parshas Pinchas. Parshas Pinchas describes the events of the 40th year. Remember, Miriam died in the 40th year, and Aaron died, Moshe is going to die, in the book of Devarim. And then the Jewish people are counted again in Parshas Pinchas, and this represents the generation of those who attained the age of 20 in the desert. Either they were children when they left Mitzrayim, or they were born in the desert. These were the generation of the new people who are going into it. Right? These are called the Ba'ei Ha'aretz. Now the numbers, the aggregate numbers, are more or less the same. Basically, the new generation is around the same as the old generation. But if you look at it on a tribal by tribal breakdown, it's not going to be the same. Some tribes gained,
some tribes lost. These are two different sensei. What's the plural of census? Sensei. One is the census of the Yotzei Mitzrayim, and the other is the census of Ba'ei Ha'aretz. Now, according to Rashi, there is a third census that occurred in the Chumash, although the Chumash does not record it. And this goes back, in fact, we're going to read it next week, we'll read about Parshas Shkalim. If you read Kisisa, where Hashem says, when you count the Jewish people, you should not count the Jewish people by heads. You should count the Jewish people by them giving a half shekel. And then you count the half shekels, because to count people by heads, it says, brings a magefa, brings a plague. Why is that so? I mean, we find this, for example, in Tanakh as well. In Nach as well, when Shaul needs to gather an army, so Shaul counts his army by stones, by sheep. You don't count it directly. Even when we count for a minion, we don't count people directly. There's a whole shaila in Halacha about responding to a census. Let's say you're asked to fill out how many children you have. So to say four or five, some consider that to be a violation of counting. Others say not really, because a census is tabulated by pieces of paper. So, you know, nobody's going and pointing to actual heads. But there are religious people in Israel who will not respond. Generally, you know, anything the government does becomes trafe almost automatically. But so they have this new shaila. They don't respond to a census because they consider it a violation of the prohibition against counting. Okay, but be it as it may,
we should send a few coins and then back again.
Send a few coins, right? Well, that's what they want to pay taxes. That's the other problem. But okay. But the thing is this: the thing is that according to Rashi, there was a census there as well, because the half shekel that was given, this is not the half shekel that's given every year. That's used for karbanos. That's used to buy the offerings. But this was a one-time half shekel offering that was melted down and used to make the sockets. If you remember the picture of the Mishkan was wooden boards, and the wooden boards were supported by two silver bases. Each board had a silver base, and these are called adamim, the sockets, they translate them, and the boards were inserted in the bases, and the shekelim were melted down to build those adamim. And Rashi says that itself was a census. In other words, the Jewish people were counted based on those shkalim, which means, according to Rashi, we have a total of three census, three sensei in the desert. One was a census that occurred upon the building of the Mishkan. That was after this Chedorah. That would be, we don't know exactly when the census was. I mean, that would be between... No, I'll tell you, it would be between Yom Kippur and Rosh Chodesh Nisan, because the period of construction of the Mishkan began, right? In other words, there was the sin of the golden calf, there was the breaking of the tablets, Moshe prayed, Moshe came down with the second Luchos, Yom Kippur. The beginning, Yeshivas Rebbe Tamos is when the sin of the golden calf, that's when he broke the Luchos. But he did not come, he prayed for 40 days, they went up for a second 40 days, he did not come down with the second tablets till Yom Kippur. That's why Yom Kippur is a day of forgiveness. Actually, it's not really clear what the relationship is either. It's not clear if Yom Kippur is a day of forgiveness because that is the day that God forgave the Jewish people because of the golden calf, or whether it's vice versa, because Yom Kippur is the day of forgiveness. That's why we were forgiven that day. What the cause and effect of those two events is, you could say it one of two ways. But the construction of the Mishkan began in earnest the day after Yom Kippur, when Moshe began announcing, bring these materials, etc., etc. Now, the Mishkan was constructed from the period from after Yom Kippur till the first day of Nisan. That is when the Mishkan was completed. So at some point in time, Rashi does not give us an exact date, but at some point in time, between those two events, a census was taken, which is not recorded in the Torah as a census. A census was taken to count the number of Jewish people in Klal Yisrael between the Chet HaEgel and the building of the Mishkan. Actually, there is a medrash that says the Mishkan was actually finished Hanukkah time. In other words, the Mishkan was finished between Yom Kippur and Hanukkah, except HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to defer the actual use of the Mishkan because Nisan was the month of redemption from Mitzrayim. So Hashem owed Hanukkah one. Hashem owed Hanukkah. It says that's why Hanukkah means rededication. That the Mishkan itself was ready to be used during Hanukkah time, but because it was delayed to Nisan, that's why Hanukkah later became the time that the second temple was rededicated during the Greek, Syrian Greek persecutions. Okay. Now, Rashi then makes an interesting point. Rashi makes a point. If you look at the Adanim, the Torah gives the weight of the Adanim in Shkalim. And if you divide that by half, that'll give you the number of Jews. Although there's no census, right? So Rashi raises the question. It's a little anomalous that apparently the number that you get, which is around 603,000 plus, from the Adanim, is the same number that is recorded in the book of Bamidbar. Now, there is a big difference, because the census here occurred, the first census occurred before the Mishkan was put up. It was between Yom Kippur and Nisan. The second census occurred, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, 1 month after the Mishkan was put up. Now, first you may ask a simple question. Why is there a need to have two censi so near to each other? I mean, you had one census right before Nisan, and another census a month later in Iyar. Why do you have to have two? The one in Pinchas, I understand, because that's 40 years later, and that is a census of a new generation. That's a census of a new generation. But why do you have to have one before the Mishkan and one right after the Mishkan? So Rashi himself says that this is why we say that this is a sign of God's love. Just like Lahavdil, if you have a miser, and the miser is always emptying out his coins and counting them over and over again because he gets a lot of pleasure. So Hashem counts the Jewish people whenever there's an occasion. After the sin of the golden calf, he counted the Jewish people to see, as it were, how many are surviving. And before the Mishkan, he's about to give them his divine presence. So at that point, he once again has to count them to see how many there are, although it's the same number. But then Rashi raises an interesting question. L'chaira, how could it be exactly the same number? You get counted when you're 20. When you hit the age of 20, you get counted. Now, let's assume the first census, let us say, was in Kislev. We really don't know, but it was some point between Yom Kippur and Nisan. And the second census is Iyar. Anybody who had a birthday between those first two points, who reached their 20th birthday, should have been added to the second census. So why? How could the numbers be exactly the same? Now, you could say, well, maybe the deaths, either the deaths or the retirement, hitting 60. Maybe the people who hit 60 and are out are the same as the people who hit 20 and are in. That's a possibility. Death is another possibility. Although there is a tradition that nobody died in the desert except for the recording the Chumash for those various punishments and the like. There were no natural deaths in the Midbar. So Rashi says an interesting point. Rashi says an interesting point about how you define a birthday. Rashi says that birthdays in the desert were not defined by your actual date of birth, but birthdays in the desert were defined by Rosh Hashanah. Every Rosh Hashanah, you became 1 year older. In other words, even if you were born the 29th of Elul, when it became Rosh Hashanah, you were now 1 year old. So therefore, he makes the point, since there was no intervening Rosh Hashanah between the first census and the second census, the first census, let's say, was in Kislev, the second census was in Iyar, so nobody became 20. Nobody had their 20th birthday, and therefore the numbers could be the same. The question is, where does Rosh Hashanah come in? Why is Rosh Hashanah relevant? I mean, in the Chumash, it's always Nisan, that's the beginning of the year. And yet, that would throw off Rashi's calculation, because there was an intervening Nisan, so Rashi has to resurrect Rosh Hashanah, which kind of comes out of left field, to determine that nobody had an additional birthday. The Or HaChaim gives another explanation, and this is actually a very valid hashkafa point here. The Or HaChaim says that if you look in the book of Bamidbar, you'll recall that Hashem said, when you count the census of the Jewish people from 20 to 60, do not count the tribe of Levi. Do not count the Levium. They should be counted separately. And they should be counted not from the age of 20, but from the age of 1 month old. In truth, we don't really have a number. We don't know how many Levium existed between 20 and 60. We're given a number from Shloshim Yom in 30 days. The Or HaChaim wants to suggest that in the first census, we included even Levium, because we don't have any exclusion. Levium gave a half shekel. So therefore, he wants to say like this. The second census was indeed larger than the first census. The reason the two numbers are the same is number one, included everybody, including the Levium, from age 20 upwards. Number two excluded Levium and had a separate calculation from age 30 days. Therefore, in fact, there was a net increase in the second census, because the number in the second census that is the same, in other words, the point is the increase of the Jewish people corresponded exactly numerically to the number of Levim that were included in the first census. Now, the anonymous census, the one that is not recorded as a census. So, now it's interesting, if you compare what I call the anonymous census, the one that is not recorded as a census, but that Rashi says existed, with the second census, you see three distinctions. Very interesting. Distinction number one is, Levim were included in the first one, and they were not included in the second one, and they were counted from 30 days. Distinction number two is, that first Minyan was not a tribal Minyan. The anonymous census does not give you a tribal breakdown. It just gives you a total. People gave a half shekel. There's no record of how many Ruvains, how many Shimons. Just 603,000. The one in Bamidbar is already a breakdown, a tribal breakdown, as is the one in Pinchas. Now, a third distinction, it depends on a machlokas already. The third distinction is, was the census in Bamidbar via a half shekel? It's not really clear, because in the beginning of Bamidbar, it does not say specifically that they're counted by giving a half shekel. Now, Rashi always learns that when the Torah says in Kisisa, whenever you count the Jewish people, they have to be through shekel, that is a universal rule. So Rashi says, the one in Bamidbar was through a shekel as well. The difference is, the half shekel in Kisisa was used for the Adonim, used for the Sakkot. The one in Bamidbar is the annual half shekel that you give for the Korban. But the Ramban has a suggestion that indeed, perhaps the census in Bamidbar, and even in Pinchas, did not require a half shekel, but half a shekel was that one-time thing. So it's interesting that the second minyan did not require half a shekel. So according to Ramban, we have that third distinction. The two distinctions are according to everybody. Well, each one depends. The one distinction that is absolutely true, according to all opinions, is the anonymous minyan of Kisisa did not involve tribal breakdowns. Bamidbar involved a tribal breakdown. That is an absolute, clear distinction between the two. The second distinctions are already controversial. According to the Aruch Chaim, the first minyan included Levim, the second minyan did not, and that's how you get the numbers are the same. Rashi gave the other explanation about birthdays. And according to Ramban, the first minyan had the shekel, half shekel, and the second minyan, by the second I mean the one in Bamidbar, did not. Right, but we have these distinctions. They were counted directly. The Gul Gulasam, Ramban says, by the heads. They counted them by the heads. That there was no permanent. Ramban wants to suggest that there was no permanent prohibition against counting the Jewish people by heads. And he offers different interpretations about that.
How does it count?
Well, that's that's a problem. But the Aruch Chaim wants to suggest. No, it seems to be exact, because it's not rounded. It gives you an exact number. So, but what's interesting is that there are two notions of community that a person gets, right? The giving of a shekel, giving of a half a shekel, right? The idea is each of us is only half, we need each other. Half shekel is interdependence, the notion that one cannot survive in this world being alone. But there are really two different visions of community that a human being can have. One is the community of conformity, everybody melt together, the melting pot. I guess the melting pot in the salad bowl is an easy way to describe it. In the melting pots, everything gets melted and becomes one big mush. The individual unique components of the mixture are dissolved and they become one uniform type of thing, like an alloy of metal. And the other is the salad bowl, where you have tomatoes and lettuce and everything else. And you still have the tomatoes and the lettuce, but they're in one bowl, and they're mixed together. Now, the American model for many years, the old public school training grounds, was very clearly the melting pot. America was the melting pot, where you come to school and you kind of abandon the custom of the past. Today, we have salad bowls, and that really gives rise to a lot of tension, where you have bilingualism and all sorts of other things. So everybody should keep their own culture. Now, the emes is that which is more desirable may depend on the external conditions that a society faces. When society faces external threats, when they're in a time of crisis, that is a time when people must come together and perhaps forget about their individual
agendas. You don't pursue your individual agenda, your own thing, when you're in a time of war or a time of crisis. However, ultimately, the Torah's vision of unity is a unity that's much more based on recognizing diversity and uniqueness than sameness. We have, of course, a basic structure of halakha that we all have to adhere to, but within that halakha, there's a lot of room for diversity and uniqueness. And it could very well be that this is reflected in the two different sensei that the Torah has. Sensus number one was in the aftermath of the Chet HaEgel, the aftermath of a Holocaust, the aftermath of a true crisis. In a true crisis, one has to be willing to sacrifice some of one's individuality and some of your uniqueness to be part of a common cause to combat that which is destroying you. Just like after the Holocaust, you have to join hands, you have to build together. And thus, in the first minyan, there is no notion of tribes, because tribe especially represents the idea of diversity within a common community. Each tribe had its own flag. Each tribe had its own mission. Like Yisachar was the tribe that specialized in Limud HaTorah, and Zevulun was in commerce and supporting each other. The whole notion of not everybody's the same, everybody has their own different drummer that they march to. The Ari says, by the way, the famous statement of the Ari, that the origin of the different Yuschos HaTfilah, right, of Ashkenaz and Sephardim, he says, originally each tribe had its own sitter. Each tribe had its own sitter. And just like in the Beis HaMikdash, there were 12 gates. Each tribe had a special gate they would enter the Beis HaMikdash in. But then there was a 13th gate, the Ari says, for those who know tribe. This was good for everybody. This was an all admissions gate. And the Ari made the claim that his sitter, the Nisach Ari, was the sitter for every Jew who didn't know his tribe, since we don't know our tribe. So the Nisach Ari is considered to be the preferable of all Nuschos, the Shar HaKolel, this is called, the general gate. So the notion of a Shevetz is the idea of the uniqueness within community. But the first minyan is specifically directed towards obliteration of uniqueness, because that's how you have to group together in crisis. That is why, number one, there's no tribal breakdown. And that is why, according to Ramban, there are shtolen, because shtolen is the epitome of anonymous counting. If somebody has to count me, so they see me. They see my eyes, they see my hair, they see me. But if they're just counting a bunch of coins and dividing it by two, right, to divide a half shekel, that's a totally anonymous method of counting. So that's the notion of melding yourself, losing yourself in the group. I'll explain about Levium. That's really a separate point. Why the Levium were included, why they're not included. I'll get to that. But that might be good as a short-term measure. But the ultimate purpose is that each of us should be able to reflect our uniqueness. And that is represented in the second census in the Book of Bamidbar, where, number one, there is not a tribal breakdown. The notion of uniqueness and diversity within community. And, according to Ramban, there wasn't even shtalim. In other words, people were counted as individuals because their individuality should emerge, which means obliteration. The melting pot is sometimes necessary, but it is not the optimal model for God resting his Shekhinah on Bnei Yisrael. That's exactly the point. Rashi described the first minyan was to see who survived the Egel. The second minyan, Rashi says this word, Kishabah Vahashras Shekhinah Aleihem. When God is coming to make his divine presence rest on the Jewish people. That's exactly the point. God's presence rests on the Jewish people, not when there is blind conformity, but when there is the ability of each person to bring out that facet of their neshama, which was given to them. And you see that exactly in the census. That really explains why all these different sentences, because Hashem is giving you different lessons for different times of your life to respond a different way.
I guess there again the question is what's causing what effect is the diversity cause the God's presence to be with us, or is it only have God's presence that we're going to diverge?
Well, yeah, it could go both ways. I think there's a symbiotic relationship, and that is the more we can cultivate every new drive, the more God's presence comes to us. And the more God's presence comes to us, that opens up new avenues of our own expression. So it goes both ways. We start a little bit, and then they're able to open up more, so it goes in that, it builds on each thing.
Is the Bible Rambam Shita that you could count by him?
Rabban.
Rabban. So why was David HaMelech punished?
Yeah, he goes into that Arichas. The Rabban wants to suggest that the reason, remember, the problem is at the end of Shmuel Beis, David ordered Yoav to count the people, and it seemed to be by heads, and because of this, a great plague came on Bnei Yisrael. So the Ramban offers, so this seems to be, this seems to support Rashi's position that you're not allowed to count Jewish people by heads. But Ramban offers two other explanations. He says that the prohibition there was not that it was a head count, but that it was a counting for no legitimate purpose. He says that David was proud of his vast empire, and he simply wanted to pride himself on how much he had. And the Ramban suggests that if there's a legitimate purpose for his census, then it is permitted. And the other answer he gives, an interesting answer, he says, the permissibility of a census is only if they're above 20, then Esrim Shana, and David for some reason was counting people above Bar Mitzvah. And he says that was the Madeifa. And again, he has an unusual interpretation. The Gemara is not, I mean, the Ramban is not following the Gemara. The Gemara fairly clearly says that it is usher to count Israel. But the Ramban says, according to Pshat, you have to understand that the biblical commentators, even those like Rashi and Ramban, Ramban certainly was not an anti-Talmudist. I mean, Ramban's greatest achievements were in Gemara. But very often the Ramban will explain verses of the Chumash according to Pshat. He will say that halacha, of course, you cannot argue with the Gemara, but in terms of the biblical meaning of a verse, he will offer explanations which are not always consistent with the Gemara. And here he does say that the problem with David was not the head count. The problem with David is either it was a superfluous census, or he included people below the age of 20. Now, by the way, you see, of course, all of this has implications for responding to a census. And that is, so we have three possible prohibitions here. One is the direct head count. One is counting for not a legitimate reason. And three is counting below the age of 20. Now, if you take a typical census, granted, a census normally does not involve a head count because the numbers are tabulated from the paper, not by counting heads, unless you have a census checker who comes in and knocks. That's a different problem. If you're filling out a census, it'll be tabulated on the papers. That's not a problem. Legitimate purpose, generally speaking, a census would have a legitimate purpose if it involves the apportionment of government benefits, whatever it is, like the American census determines benefits and representation. However, if you get into this other thing, that counting people below the age of 20 raises a problem. I mean, that would indeed... So every time you say you have, you know, five children below the age of 13, what kind of number becomes a census? I mean, certainly if somebody asks you how many children you have, now some people will not respond, by the way. You may have met people who will never tell you how many children they have. And it might be because they're tied into this, but generally speaking, nobody says la halacha, it is forbidden to say how many children you have, but when it's undertaken as part of a population census, Ramban suggests there's a problem, even if you're doing it indirectly. In other words, the issue of David had nothing to do with direct. Then you have another question. So why did Shaul count the army one time with sheep? It's, by the way, the Gemara makes a comment. This thing about Shaul doing it indirectly is mentioned twice. One time, he counted pebbles. Everyone gave a rock, and he counted a pebble. The Yifkadei Babazak. Some say Bazak is a makam, but other say Bazak is a pebble. The other time it says V'yifkadei Batla'im. He counted sheep. Huh? Some say Pesach, but Rashi quotes this. Rashi says, the first time is when Shaul waged war before he was anointed king. In other words, he was a hero before that. The Tla'im was the war against the Amalek who became kings. And you see, the concept is that the rich get richer. When he was a poor guy, he only took pebbles. When he becomes king, everyone has to give him a sheep, which he kept. So we have that. That's an interesting point. The Ramban doesn't make that connection, but it could very well be that the concern with the 13 maybe that he was trying to change the conscription age.
Didn't that be
Yeah.
And he didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Yoav said he didn't want to do it because he will bring a plague upon Bnei Yisrael.
No, I know that.
No, in other words...
But why have Yoav do it?
You're suggesting that what the Ramban might mean, and as the Ramban says, the device is that he's covering people below the age of 13. Maybe the device is not the counting per se. The device is lowering the conscription rate. That might be. Although the Ramban's lashon implies that there's a problem in the census per se. I think that's a good point.
One thing that they've learned, sometimes people, if they want to count all people in the room instead of
they say a pusik.
Now, how does that make it not?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the pusik. In other words, if you're counting a minion, Hoshia Samecha has ten words to it. So you're counting the word. But if you're pointing to people, I'm not sure how that.
It seems to be focusing on the wrong issue.
Yeah, the problem is the count. Now there is a point. Again, the concept of head counting is the idea of singling out people. So again, you get to this idea that when the community notion is obliteration into the larger mass, then that's inappropriate. If it's to highlight uniqueness, then that would be appropriate. Rashi's position is that you never try this uniqueness. Ramban would say sometimes it is right. Yeah.
Yeah, something suggested itself to me from a class, a Gemara shiur that I'm taking, Nedarim. We're studying Perek Rabbi, and something with this question, a census with Shkolim versus something else. This discussed in the concept there of Mavriach Arei that if you send Shkolim off and they didn't arrive there, you're not responsible. And that's, you know, you.
Right.
So, obviously, when I know you say the word Medrash. You know, is it approximate or is it really accurate? Maybe the census with Shkolim cannot be really considered 100% accurate. I mean, if it doesn't arrive and you're not responsible.
Yeah, you're raising an excellent question. First of all, let me emphasize one thing. The people get confused. The half shekel that it was given every year, and that we still give as a memory, we give a quarter, we give a half dollar. That was not used as a census device. They did not make a census every year. That's a separate mitzvah to give a half shekel towards the upkeep of the Beis HaMikdash. It happened to be at various times in history, it did a double duty function. So according to Rashi, the first Machtis HaShekel that they gave for the Mishkan was used to count the census in the Book of the Midbar. See, the Machtis HaShekel they gave for the first census, that was used for the Adonim. That was not used for the Karmanos. That's a one-time thing. So that year was in the desert. So there, in Moshe knew, I mean, basically there was nothing to get lost because there was no transportation cost. The Machtis HaShekel given every year, indeed, a lot of it gets lost. Some people don't give. And therefore, you're right, that would not be an accurate census device. But it wasn't even used as a census device, normally. But you're suggesting what? The fact that it's not exact is a reason it should be used because that way you don't have an exact number.
No. I mean, if you want an exact, then you wouldn't use. You know, you said one is done this way, one is done that way.
So right.
Maybe you
right,
wouldn't
right.
use Shkolim. One could fall down on the floor.
That could be true, but I guess in the midbar there tended not to be that problem. I mean, there was no transportation. Now, one other point, just the other distinction I had mentioned, which really goes off in a different direction. Levi, Yorah Chaim says. In the first census, you included Levi. In the second census, Levi was counted separately from 30 days, not from Ben Esrim. Why was Levi? Well, this really got into a different problem. That is, the tribe of Levi represents in Klal Yisrael that force that is totally spiritual. The Levim did not have lands. They were not involved in politics. They were supposed to spend all of their time learning Torah, being the teachers of Bnei Yisrael. It's interesting. Meshech Chacham makes the observation. The Torah wants Kohanim and Levim not to have land, so they should spend time in divine service. How many days a year did the typical Kohanim serve in the Beis HaMikdash? Of course, in the Mishkan, they did it every day because you didn't have too many Kohanim. All you had was Aaron, and then you only had three Kohanim. But if you take it, let's say, in David's time and Shlomo's time, Kohanim were divided into 24 groups. Now, each group at various points may have comprised hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of Kohanim. So what happened? So you have 24 groups, a Mishmar, it's called. A Mishmar would have the service for a week. The Mishmar was subdivided into seven groupings for each day, and each grouping is called a Beis Av. Now, a Beis Av might have consisted of 100 Kohanim, 200 Kohanim. And then they would draw lotteries that day to determine which of the 100 or so Kohanim would do the various services. In other words, there were more Kohanim on any day than there was service. Now, Yom and Tovim were different. Shalosh Regalim, all Kohanim were able to. You had thousands and thousands of Kohanim, we drew lots, etc. But generally, during the week, you had a Beis Av, a single Mishmar, and a Beis Av. Now, if there are 24 Mishmaros, that means each Mishmar had 2 weeks a year, and some Mishmaros had 3 weeks a year. Right? You divide the number of weeks by 24, you'll have two and the remainder. Now, within a Mishmar, a Beis Av would have 2 days a year, or 3 days a year, because right? Now, within that, you had to draw lots. So some Kohanim may have gone through the whole year without having any service at all. Think about it. At most, if a Kohen was lucky, if we factor out the Yom Tovim, which were different, we factor out the Yom Tovim, at most, the most a Kohen could possibly have done service in the temple was 3 days a year. This is, number one, if he belonged to a Mishmar that had three turns, and he got a lottery on his day of the Beis Av. At most. So it's interesting that the Torah says, in order to serve Hashem for 3 days a year, you're not supposed to own land, you're not supposed to have business, you're supposed to be totally devoted to Hashem. Why? Because you have to be ready to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. But that's only 3 days a year at a maximum. So the end, huh? No, that's what I'm saying. So the concept is, to truly serve Hashem properly, even 1 day a year, you need an entire year of preparation. It's not too little. You need to be free the whole year to be able to approach Hashem properly for the 1, 2, or 3 days that you're going to do it. Again, I was talking yesterday about the idea of hachana, the idea of preparing yourself to do mitzvahs, not just doing the mitzvahs, but preparing yourself to do them properly. And you really see a very graphic example in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, going to the Levium, the truth is, in the desert existence, all of the Jewish people were essentially living this spiritual existence. They had the man from heaven. They had to travel. By the way, just again, just a little digression. The Gemara says, where did the well of Miriam go? When the Jews came to Eretz Israel, the well of Miriam dried up after Miriam died, but then when Moshe hit it, that was the well of Miriam that gave out its water again. Where did the well of Miriam go? So the well of Miriam, it says, followed the Jews into Eretz Yisrael, but it somehow found itself emptied itself into the Yam Kineret, the Sea of Galilee. I don't know how it got it. It went upstream of the Jordan. I don't know exactly how it got up there. But it found itself in the Yam Kineret. And the Ari taught, the great Mekubal taught, that if one can drink of the water of the Yam Kineret, in which there is mixed in the water of Miriam's well, so the gates of wisdom will be opened up, because that was a water that was not just plain water, it was the water of wisdom. So the story goes that Rav Chaim Vital, who was the Ari's great disciple, the Ari took him when he wanted to be initiated in the learning of Kabbalah. The Ari took him for a boat ride on the Yam Kineret, and at a certain spot, he told him, drink this water. And he says, this is the water from the well of Miriam that will open up your mind to be receptive to these secrets. Okay, but neither of them. We do see that in the Midbar, the spiritual level of the Jewish people was that, like the Levian, every Jew was really a lady, learning Torah. I mean, there was nothing physical to do. However, when they come to Eretz Yisrael, life is going to be different. They have to be involved in building the land, fighting. They no longer have the purely spiritual existence. They live, of course, under God's guidance, but they live under the laws of nature, not the laws of the supernatural. Well, the book of Bamidbar is a transition between the purely spiritual level of the 40 years and entering Eretz Yisrael. In fact, if you go through the book of Bamidbar, a lot of the clashes that the Jewish people face are these clashes between the material and the spiritual. For example, the story of the spies. The Nitziv says that sort of the spies can be understood as the spies, Rashi says, were tzaddikim. Why are they telling the Jewish people not to go to Israel? Because they say, you know, we could do better off in the desert. In the desert, we could be more spiritual, we could be close to God. We're not ready to dirty our hands in the grubby business of politics and war. Let's stay in a spiritual existence a little more. And you can go through a lot of stories like that. The story about the slav, the quail, shows the dangers of physicality, that once they get involved in eating meat, they really get to an extreme. It really carries them away. So the book of Bamidbar is the uneasy transition between pure spirituality and the need to be involved in the world. Now, the concept is this. The first census represents the Jewish people in a purely spiritual mode. That first census, because Levi is now has a common denominator with the rest of the Jewish people, because they're all living on that exalted level of existence. The book of Bamidbar, which is already the book which is bringing us towards Eretz Yisrael, at that point Levi is separated out, because there's a recognition that the Levi-like spiritual existence is not going to be that which the Jewish people as a whole are going to face. So you see all sorts of things in these little technical details. You can see all sorts of ideas that are being brought out, the role of Levi, the role of the Jewish person, the notion of melting pot versus salad bowl. Even in all of these things, these ideas are brought out. Okay, now, why am I bringing this here? I'm bringing this here by way of introduction. So it comes out that we have three enumerations. We have the hidden enumeration, which is the Adonim, that's in the sockets of the Mishkan. We have the census of Yotzei Mitzrayim right after the Mishkan is built in the beginning of the Midbar. Then we have the second or third census at the end of the Torah, Parshas Pinchas, which is the generation of Bo'ei Ha'aretz, those who are going to enter Eretz Yisrael. They are the new generation. Now, Eretz Yisrael was divided up so that people will get a portion of lands. Now the question is, the Gemara has a machlokas. Was Eretz Yisrael divided up based on those who left Egypt or based on those who entered Eretz Yisrael? Let me give you an example of how this would work. Let's assume that you have a man, Reuben, who leaves Egypt. He leaves Egypt at the age of 25. In the course of his travels in the desert, Reuben has two children, Shimon and Levi. Reuben dies in the desert because he was of the generation of the spies. And he has two sons, Shimon and Levi, who enter Eretz Yisrael at the age of 25. Now, Eretz Yisrael will be given to Shimon and Levi. Reuben is dead. But the question is Eretz Yisrael divided up based on those who left, with Shimon and Levi simply inheriting Reuben? In other words, the concept would be, would Shimon and Levi get one portion of land, which would then be divided two ways? Because essentially we would regard the land as being given to Reuben, and Shimon and Levi are just heirs who split. Or do we ignore the first census entirely and simply divvy up Eretz Yisrael based on the people who enter the land? So Shimon and Levi enter the land, they get two portions. See, either way, Eretz Yisrael was divided up into 603,000 portions, because these are the numbers of people. But the problem is, that's the same number you have under the first census, and that's the number you have in the second census. So the question is, did we divide it up into 603 portions based on the people who left from Egypt, and then decisions were based on inheritance principles? Or did we directly divide it based on that? So one opinion in the Gemara says, Eretz Yisrael was divided based on those who left Mitzrayim, because they are...
Is it?